Workers and labor organizations around the world are a crucial component of the massive movement in solidarity with the Palestinian people that has emerged since the Israeli genocide campaign began on October 8th, 2023. Today, we'll discuss key developments in the long fight to build an internationalist, anti-imperialist labor movement.
We need a new system. We need a new society. We need to demand that which may have sounded impossible even a few weeks ago, but is not only realizable, but an imperative necessity.
Welcome to the Socialist Program. I'm your host, Brian Becker. Today, we're joined by Amina Sheikh. She is a labor and community organizer in Toronto. And we're joined by Hussein Karimi. He's in New York City. He's a labor organizer and a host of the podcast On the Line. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Well, in the coming days, the coming weeks, there's going to be more massive demonstrations all around the United States. That's where I am. Amina, I know you're in Canada. There's going to be big protests upcoming. There's the May Day protest here in New York City. I know that's going to have a Palestine focus. There has been a sea change in terms of the orientation of the labor movement. It's not complete. It's not finished, but it's certainly underway here in the United States. But Amina, let's talk to you about Canada. What's going on? What's the role of labor? And just talk about how the change has happened.
Yeah, thank you for having me once again. And yeah, I like that you did mention it's not perfect and it's not finished and it's ongoing. And I think a lot's been happening since October 7th, but a lot has been happening over the decades and over the years. You know, before I became a union organizer, I too was a student and, you know, it's only then I remember, like, you know, being at school and remembering what BDS campaigns were happening on my campus. And now all of this has come to fruition. And now I've been an organizer for 10 years and I'm watching my nieces and my nephews on campus and them understand what BDS is and BDS actually having, you know, really tangible wins. And what I mean by that is, you know, across Canada, there have been unions that have put motions right after October 7th, calling for a ceasefire, of course, but also going beyond the ceasefire language and talking about arms embargo. And this started happening early on, as well as calling Israel an apartheid as it is, right? And so this work, I think, was going on for decades. And we're really seeing in this moment, labor unions, some labor unions, right? Like it's not perfect, but some labor unions really stepping up and going beyond the language of a ceasefire. And we have seen major unions like CUPE here, which is the Canadian Union for Public Employees, the leader Fred Hahn, who always has been a champion of working people, the working class, the poor. You know, he really has stood by the Palestinian community over the years. And also we have seen at our protests and mobilizations, a former Federation, Ontario Federation of Labor leader, Sid Ryan, who is an Irish immigrant and very beloved in the community here, very beloved by the Palestinian community. He has been at the forefront of many of our protests, and he really has done great work in making the connection to Irish people's struggles and Palestinian people's struggles. And really those connections between different communities here in Toronto and across Canada, whether it's immigrant diaspora, whether it's Indigenous people fighting for land back, you know, the connections are very important because that political education has helped us see how Palestine is an issue that all of us care about. And it's not just an issue for Muslims and it's not just an issue for Arabs, you know, and it's been working great. And I think also what we've been seeing is mobilizations across the country. But I would say that those mobilizations are not led by labor. They're led by workers, people, community organizations, and really they've rapidly coalesced and come together and collaborated, and we're seeing collaborations keep happening, whether people are academics, art workers, whether they are early childhood educators, teachers. I mean, the list is really long, and I know it's in the US as well, where every form of worker is really involved. And I think pressuring their local leadership, pressuring their local candidates, but also going beyond that. And what I was going to say, and maybe we'll talk about that later, is I've been involved with some direct actions that are happening at weapons manufacturing facilities. So I think we're seeing people go beyond the ceasefire language. Obviously, it's not perfect. And, you know, labor in Canada, just like labor in the United States, you know, has played a role alongside the state, has played a role alongside industry and capitalism. And, you know, after World War II, it played a role in purging our unions and involved in Red Scare here. So I think you have factions and you have contradictions, but they're good. And we're seeing the language of an arms embargo happen rapidly here.
Thank you so much for that. Hussein, that's the report from Toronto. Let's talk about the United States. I mean, there is a history here. And for the audience, I want to be able to sort of introduce some of that history. The labor movement for a long time, the AFL-CIO, especially in the 60s, the 70s, into the 80s, even into the 90s and beyond, was a firm supporter of the State of Israel. The Israeli Zionist movement, the U.S. government, the CIA, they all paid careful attention to the labor movement because how labor functions, where it stands, how workers think and feel, the consciousness of workers, very, very critically important to maintaining the dominant narrative that Israel is a place, a safe haven for Jewish people, that it's a place where labor and democracy bloom. The Palestinians for that entire period were basically demonized as terrorists. Every effort to reclaim the land, to go back to homes and villages from which the Palestinian people had been dispossessed, all of that was completely demonized, and it was almost impossible, even when we started to have big protests for Palestine in the 1990s, and especially starting in 2002 with the Israeli reinvasion of the West Bank, the labor movement was very, you know, missing. They were missing. The labor movement was missing, with the exception of a handful of a few radical small committees. That's changed a lot right now. The Palestinian people, including the Palestinian resistance forces, are demanding a permanent ceasefire. They're demanding a lot more than that, but right now a permanent ceasefire, and the Israeli regime refuses that demand. The U.S. has basically vetoed ceasefire demands, three of them at the United Nations. And while the labor movement in the United States is generally voting Democratic, many important labor leaders and important labor unions, including United Auto Workers, took a stand in contrast to the Biden administration. Let's just talk about the dimensions of this change.
Yeah, no, I think it's well said. I mean, right now, over 200 unions representing over 9 million workers have called for a ceasefire. That's a majority of union members in this country. And I think it's worth putting into context because only 10% of workers in the United States are organized into unions. And that number is around half of the public sector. Only 6% of workers in the private sector are organized. So the labor movement as a whole has been sort of decimated in the last several decades. And as a result, the sort of sharpest political elements from the labor movement haven't been as present, which is not a coincidence when we think about the weakness organizationally of the labor movement. But even though the resolution, I think, as both you, Brian, and Amina alluded to, the sort of core resolution that all these unions have adopted is imperfect. The way it's being reported, which I think is a good thing, is that X union calls for a ceasefire, which at its core is in opposition to the consensus position of the US government. And those unions include, like you mentioned, Brian, the United Auto Workers, the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, hospital workers unions like NNU, even the building trades, International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, educators through the NEA. So really large, prominent unions that represent hundreds of thousands, and in some cases over a million workers have called for a ceasefire, some going further than others. You mentioned the UAW. The day they announced the resolution that they had adopted, they held a press conference outside of the White House. And it's actually been, even though they've endorsed Biden, after the endorsement, they haven't dropped the issue, which I think is important. And they haven't just adopted a ceasefire resolution. They put together a working group at the international level to explore the issue of divestment from Israeli apartheid, including pension funds. To what extent can they negotiate these things in their contracts? The workers at Chicago Ford Assembly Plant, UAW Local 551, they adopted a resolution after the international adopted a resolution. These workers at the auto plant in Chicago adopted a resolution that called for an end to weapons shipments to Israel. So the fact that so many unions have adopted a ceasefire resolution has given space to many of the locals to go even further. And I think on the whole, as far as the movement, it's normalized the position of a ceasefire and has brought the politics of internationalism to so many millions of workers who, absent of these resolutions, may see it on the surface as an issue that's irrelevant to them, but now it's being connected in a real concrete way.
Yeah, and this is the byproduct of hard work by labor activists like the two of you, who have been pounding away for a long time, along with other people in the labor movement, sort of bringing Palestine to the fore, bringing international anti-imperialist politics to the fore, however the language is. Maybe it's not the language of anti-imperialism explicitly, but the core message. In the case of the U.S., Hussein, I'll just ask you a quick follow-up question and then go back to Amina. The American Postal Workers Union and the National Association of Letter Carriers, those are the two biggest unions for the Postal Service. And, you know, this is a huge, important union, lots of workers, you know, very connected to U.S. households because of the delivery of mail. The American Postal Workers Union leadership has actually come out in support of the ceasefire, but beyond that, also because the president of the union is Jewish, explaining why Zionism is in fact a retrograde ideology, that it's not about the liberation of Jews or anyone, it's an ideology connected to colonialism. These are significant developments.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you mentioned the Postal Workers Union. I think they were among the first to take such a strong stance. And there was a New York Times article actually about Mark Diamonstein, the president of APWU, his interventions in the AFL's executive council around calling for a ceasefire. And I'd like to think that had a real impact moving, you know, the largest labor federation in the United States to take more of a progressive stance, albeit, you know, a couple months after the initial set of resolutions that were adopted. And you're right. I mean, the postal workers are responsible for the largest federal strike in U.S. history in 1970. And their militancy in that period sort of was built off of the civil rights movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement, and employs, you know, a ton of nationally oppressed Black workers who were, you know, were the cutting edge of the strike at the time. And so they do actually have a rich political history, and the fact that they have taken such a stand on a ceasefire, but also starting to explain the logic of apartheid and occupation and Zionism to so many hundreds of thousands of workers, I think just speaks to the resurgence of an introduction, reintroduction of the question of politics that go beyond the bread and butter issues in the workplace to the labor movement writ large.
I'm in a transformation in consciousness, including the transformation to radical and even revolutionary consciousness, that's always a process. It's never like people don't start at one place and like they're already there. There's a process, and you know, and Hussein knows, everyone who's involved in labor organizing knows that you have to kind of keep working day in and day out, because the dominant narrative is always shaped by the class enemy. It's always shaped by the capitalist or the capitalist media. I'm thinking about this because back in the day when the anti-apartheid movement really took off in the 1980s, especially in the United States. And the labor movement became such a major factor in it. And there was the Boycott South Africa. And you mentioned BDS, which is Boycott, Divest, Sanctions for Israel, similar to the boycott of South Africa in the 1980s that ultimately led to the end of apartheid and black majority political rule. The white ruling class hasn't disappeared in South Africa, but this major advance with black political majority rule happened as a consequence of the struggle inside South Africa, but then the struggle all around the world to boycott this racist apartheid government. Well, in 1980, this was like 3 or 4 years before the movement took off, the U.S. AFL-CIO, including some of the most progressive forces in the AFL-CIO, were still opposing the boycott on South Africa because the movement in South Africa had been demonized. The African National Congress had been demonized as a communist movement, as a red movement. And as a result, the labor movement was either reactionary or scared to take a stance. 3 years later, all of that changed. The labor movement was brought into the movement, and labor, as a consequence, became a major force. And all of the millions of black workers, especially, but also their white and Latino and Asian American and Middle Eastern co-workers, they all came into that movement. That made such a difference. This is a process. And I just wanted to talk to you about Canada, because in many ways, what happens in Canada frequently is just a step or two ahead of what happens in the United States. But explain to us, explain especially to the U.S. audience that may not know about it as much, how things are moving in Canada, how rapidly they're moving, and what the main dynamics are.
Yeah, I think things sometimes feel a bit different than the United States. And I know I saw that global leaders and people were like sort of applauding Canada on this recent motion that the NDP and the Liberal Party passed recently. And it's about basically a step towards an arms embargo. But we have to understand that just like the United States and frankly in other countries, the Canadian government, you know, the Canadian state, like the Israeli state, is a settler colonial state, right? And it has a history and continuum of genocide, dispossession, you know, displacement of Indigenous people, but also that the labor movement in many ways, you know, follows the lead of the Canadian state and works with industries. And why I'm saying that is that even internally in Canada with our domestic affairs, you know, when it comes to energy pipelines, when it comes to, you know, the cost of food, when it comes to education, we're seeing the exact same situation that's in the United States. We have austerity, you know, we have constant cuts to all our public health care and education. And really what we know and what people are learning in this moment very rapidly and where the change is happening is that there's so much political consciousness with ordinary people that why are millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars going towards a genocide? And I think we have to place it in a particular context. And why I want to situate it in what happened with the pandemic is because the pandemic didn't finish and then it impacted working people and poor people. Because we saw food crisis, we saw inflation, we saw a housing crisis. That's not really different from the United States. But I want to also say right before October 7th happened, we had Zelensky touring Canada for millions and millions and millions of taxpayer dollars. And already in that moment in September 2023, people in this country were saying, why are we giving this war, this ongoing war, so much money? When we don't have money for housing, we don't have money for food, we don't have money for anything here. So it's not that different from the United States. We don't have roads in rural communities. You know, we don't have proper infrastructure, but we have millions of dollars for Zelensky. And right after September, which if you guys remember, we also saw our government applauding a Nazi in government who is linked to one of our ministers, Chrystia Freeland, whose grandfather was also a Ukrainian Nazi, you know, so all of this happened September 2023. And then we saw Israeli attacks on Palestinian people and October 7th happened, right? So it all is situated in that context. And I think people were already fed up. This is what I think. Working people were already fed up and they were already asking questions of the liberal government. And we weren't getting proper responses from our Social Democrat Party, the NDP. And I don't really see in this moment any of the party leaders being leaders in this moment. I think they follow the people and the movements. And so I really don't see them as leaders, but I see people in their unions and workers being leaders in this moment. And that's where we're seeing rapid change because they're coming together, collaborating. And when I say collaborating, you have all these different organizations and rank and file workers, whether they are in education, they're nurses, they're in the environmental movement, they're indigenous land defenders, all of them from Toronto to Yellowknife to Whitehorse to British Columbia to Newfoundland. There's protests, mobilizations, and direct actions happening everywhere, along with pressuring their local leaders. And I think people have really lost faith in all of the parties. And I think people are really not believing in electoral politics as much as they did. And I think that had to do a lot with the pandemic and the ongoing investment in the European war that's happening between Ukraine and Russia.
Very, very interesting. Hussein, go back to you. Amina said, it's not the politicians who are leading, it's the people who are leading. And Palestine is a catalyst, the genocide, which people are able to witness in real time. For the first time in humanity's history, people are actually watching day by day, hour by hour, a genocide being committed. Maybe it's not in the corporate mainstream media, but people can watch on social media. And at the same time, a mass movement in the United States, in Canada, throughout the Middle East, all over the world, in solidarity with the Palestinian people and in opposition to the genocide. This is a combustible mix. And so the people are leading and the politicians are reacting. The politicians are reacting. They're not leading. They're not doing something out of good faith when they say, we support a ceasefire. That's not a gift given to somebody. That's a concession wrung from political leaders. In the case of Canada, what Amina was mentioning, the Canadian House of Commons passed a non-binding vote calling for an end to future arms sales to Israel. And the Canadian foreign minister said, it's a real thing, meaning that this is not just a resolution, even if it's non-binding. Whether it is or isn't, that's not my point. For the United States, which is the leader of an imperialist camp, the imperial camp, which includes Canada and Britain first and foremost, but others, the other members of the G7, when there is a fraying of the alliance of any type, and I'm thinking back to when the House of Commons in the UK voted against the British government at that time, the Tory government, to support what appeared to be a war that the U.S., the Obama administration, was about to launch against Syria in August, September 2013, it created this fissure, this fracture within ruling class politics in the United States, and Obama pulled back, not because of altruism. He got cold feet. He got cold feet about launching another regional war, but the dissolution of the alliance as a consequence of mass pressure, and we're talking about labor, Labor is not leading the Palestine support movement, but it's now kind of becoming part of it. These are like all of the sort of various grassroots factors that actually become part of the calculations of imperial foreign policy makers. Anyway, that's the way I see it. I want to know if you feel there's that kind of consciousness in the labor movement that what labor is doing here, even if it's just kind of in a way getting started, whether it makes a difference.
Well, I think it definitely does. I remember the day that Brandon Mancilla, Sean Fain, and other union leaders were speaking outside of the White House and just talking to other people in the movement, some people who weren't as familiar and active in the Palestine movement. And the consensus in the room was that, wow, like it's no longer, and obviously my opinion wasn't that it was ever fringe, but that the fact that unions representing hundreds of thousands of workers are going to jump into the mix and take a position that is in opposition to a ruling party that historically they've been sort of tied to the hip with, the Democratic Party. And typically in every sort of election cycle, the endorsements come rolling out for the Democrats very, very early on. So the fact that so many unions would take a stance that they know speaks to so many millions of young people who are largely the base of this massive upsurge in political activity and in opposition to the genocide against Palestinians, the fact that they've decided to take this position has a real impact. And we know that the Democratic Party really relies on union endorsements to, you know, support their ticket, but really also for GOTV efforts. I mean, unions put in enormous resources to canvass for Democratic Party candidates in swing states. I think SEIU, hundreds of millions of dollars every election cycle. So not that that core relationship has fundamentally changed, but it has ruptured. And the position that they've adopted around a ceasefire and introducing anti-imperialism, anti-war politics to their membership can't be taken away. So people remember that and people are now learning about it. Some people who wouldn't have otherwise. And, you know, I mentioned young people. I think the labor movement, given that only 10% of workers are in unions, if you think about young people, they're the group of people who are the least organized in the workforce, but they have the highest popularity rating for unions. 88% of those under 30 support unions. And so the labor movement correctly identifies this group of people as the group that's capable of leading a resurgence in the labor movement, expanding its ranks beyond that 10, 11, 12% number, but into the 20s, 30s, and, you know, in the majorities, which, you know, there's a long way to go for that, but that's obviously had an impact on their willingness and, in the best cases, desire to jump into the political arena and into a position that they know the Democratic Party opposes.
That's an important point and an interesting point. And Amina, I want to talk to you about the same point. The demographic element within the labor movement and the broader mass movement in support of Palestine, it's young people. It's largely young people. And, you know, there was that recording of the ADL's misnamed Anti-Defamation League report to a Zionist and Israeli sort of conference, internal conference about how to manage the sea change in consciousness, which is moving so decisively against Israel. The ADL representative said, look, this is not, he said, it's not a left-right thing. This is a young, old thing, meaning we have lost young people. We have, as he put it, a major, major, major problem because young people now, as he put it, support Hamas. Well, what he really means is that they oppose Israeli genocide. There's all kinds of different political viewpoints on the Palestinian movement, I mean, within the movement. But the point was, young people have turned against the genocide, and young people are never going to go back. I don't think the people who are in the streets right now for Palestine, the people who are, even if they're not yet in the streets, they're outraged by the genocide that they're witnessing, especially young people. That's not going to change. They're not going to go back and start to become, you know, supporters of the Israeli Zionist narrative. And that has huge implications for the labor movement because the people, as you're putting it, it's the people at the grassroots who make change. But historically, it's young people who make change. How is it there in Canada, and what's your evaluation of this part of the issue?
Yeah, I agree with everything that's being said here. I do think it's a lot of young workers, and we mentioned the postal workers, CUPW, which is the Canadian Union of Postal Workers, historically was always a militant union, you know, and never actually endorses political candidates and actually doesn't really have a history of being so close to the Social Democrat Party here. But CUPW is a perfect example of a union that has always supported the international campaign of boycott, divestment, and sanction, and actually brought delegations to apartheid Israel, brought delegations to Palestine, and also did the work of bringing Palestinian postal worker to labor notes. And in the United States, where we heard from delegates from Palestine, who are also from trade unions. And I think a lot of young workers have received that political education. But I think that, yeah, they're just in a different place. You know, like I said, the pandemic happened, and I think that impacted the workforce globally. And I think that they were already questioning the hyper-militarism in their cities. We are seeing hyper-militarism in the cities of Toronto, in the cities of Winnipeg. It's not just the United States, New York City, Atlanta, and all these places where people are watching that, but it's happening in Canada. And that happened, and then October 7th. And I think I put it in that context that people were connecting the dots. And they were like, okay, so I can't afford a house and I can't afford food, but you're going to fund Israeli genocide to kill babies, mothers, children, fathers, entire generations are being wiped off. And you're going to tell me in this moment, you want to talk to me about, you know, different historical dates and polemics and intellectualizing every situation? They're like, absolutely not. And young people do their research. And they are watching, and they are watching the harrowing videos, you know, and I think that the tools that they use, that young people use, the older generation could not catch up to, and they couldn't catch up in the pandemic as well. And I think that the tools have helped them see through social media, through ground journalism, through alternative, you know, news like this one. People have got their information in front of them and they're saying no. And I'm really inspired by young people and their work inside the unions. And I'm really inspired by, you know, all sorts of workers that are saying absolutely no and holding leaders, whether it's their union leaders, whether it's hospital CEOs, holding everybody accountable and trying their best in every single way to stop this genocide.
All right. As we move to the finish line here, Hussein, I'm going to give you the last word. I think it's critically important what Amina has stated, that Palestine is like the issue in front of everyone right now, but there was the pandemic, there was the mistreatment of the working class, there was the spending billions, tens of billions, hundreds of billions of dollars for war, a proxy war against Russia in Ukraine. At the same time, the government in the United States, and as Amina is mentioning, austerity policies in Canada too, are really contributing to a huge deterioration for working class folks in America. And all of this stuff comes together. The international movement, the issues of domestic oppression, class oppression, exploitation, they all come together when people start to wake up politically. Here you have Biden. The Biden administration came in 2021. He had beaten Trump by 7 million votes in the popular vote. The Democrats had the control of the House. They had the control of the Senate. They could basically do whatever they wanted to do. Nothing was going to block them. And yet they accomplished so little. And it's even worse than accomplishing little. They're sending hundreds of billions of dollars for war, endless war in Ukraine, war, a proxy war against the Palestinian people, more for military buildup against China in the Pacific Ocean. And at the same time, all of the emergency provisions to alleviate the suffering of people from COVID have been ended. The moratorium on evictions ended. The subsidy for working class families who had children, that ended. The childhood poverty had diminished in the United States by 50% in 18 months as a result of COVID subsidies. They ended them, and now childhood poverty has gone up. It's going back to the level it was, which means that childhood poverty, the terrible deprivation of the human rights of children, forcing them into poverty, that's a policy choice. That's not inevitable. That's not natural. That's not the fault of families who are being demonized and caricatured. That's a policy choice by politicians. And when you put all of this together, you get this sort of necessity to fight, the necessity to resist. And I think this is going to have a long-standing, you know, enduring impact where young people, as they enter the labor force, they want to be in unions, they want to be anti-war, they don't want to spend money for endless death and destruction. They want money to meet human needs. I mean, this opens up a whole new era for labor organizing, With all that said, I'm going to give you the last word.
I think it's a key point you mentioned in Amina as well, that there's no going back, especially for the millions of young people who have taken a strong stand, where the disruption of politicians and companies who are complicit in genocide, it's normalized. Every day we see some politician being disrupted, mass marches being called for not just a couple weeks or a month or 2 months, but over 6 months. And so the impacts on that, on a whole new generation of activists and organizers, won't be immediately apparent. I think they're far greater than what we can see right now. And that includes so many of these people who are young workers or are going to be entering the workforce in the coming years, including, you know, many high school students who are active around the Palestine struggle. And I think part of our responsibility here is for those whose entry point into political struggle is around Palestine, around the anti-imperialist movement, which at its core is a movement against the entire logic of the U.S. capitalist system, right? Israel, there's a reason why there's such a tight consensus within the U.S. government around Israel, because it's core to the functioning of the U.S. political system and their hegemony in the region, their influence in the region. And so young people are starting to come into conflict with that reality and are searching for more radical alternative systems and solutions. And so how do we get these folks who are entering politics from this entry point to embrace the idea that in order to transform society, we need the group of people who make society run, and that's the working class. And for people to embrace the idea that the working class movement, the labor movement, is a crucial arena of struggle, and we need to grow that movement to be able to take the types of actions required to stop these genocidal policy decisions, like you said, whether it's funding Israel to the tune of tens of billions of dollars a year, or, you know, cutting healthcare, cutting, you know, so many crucial social services. It's the same enemy. The same people who are responsible for deteriorating living and working conditions in the United States are the same people who are responsible for they can always find money. They can always find a few billion here, a few billion there to send for war. And the way we can put an end to that is organization of millions of working class people where they work, and to go beyond just the bread and butter issues, but into the arena of politics, which are, you know, they're, as you mentioned, connected at the hip.
All right. Amina Hussein, thank you so much for joining the show.
You've been listening to The Socialist Program with Brian Becker, where we bring you news and views about the world for those who want to change it. If you enjoyed the show, subscribe on your favorite podcast app and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and watch video episodes of our in-depth show, The Real Story, every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern on YouTube with our partner, Breakthrough News. We can only continue our work bringing you high-quality news, analysis, and history with the support of our listeners. Connect with us and become a patron at patreon.com/thesocialistprogram and receive an invitation to participate in an exclusive monthly seminar with Brian Becker.